last half of President Kennedy's final 24 hours began when he stepped from Hotel Texas in Fort Worth and walked across the street to meet and greet thousands who had not had opportunity to see him when he made his midnight entrance into Fort Worth. The weather that morning was gloomy, misty. It had rained during the early morning hours, but the surging crowd was bright, enthusiastic, warm, and friendly. Later that morning, at the breakfast in the President's honor, the master of ceremonies would say to Mr. Kennedy, "You have brought moisture to our pastures, sunshine to our hearts." The 2,500 businessmen and women at that breakfast were jubilant. A loud, enthusiastic, Texas-sized cheer of welcome greeted Mrs. Kennedy when she arrived late at the breakfast. And then the President spoke. These were his last words.
I know now why everyone in Texas, Fort Worth, is so thin, having gotten up and down about nine times. This is what you do every morning. Mr. Buck, Mr. Vice President, Governor Connally, Senator Yarborough, Jim Wright, members of the congressional delegation, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Attorney General, ladies and gentlemen. 2 years ago, I said that, introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas. Nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear. I'm glad to be here in Jim Wright City, about 35... About 35 years ago, a congressman from California, just been elected, received a letter from an irate constituent which said, during your campaign, you promised to have the Sierra Madre Mountains reforested. You've been in office for 1 month and you haven't done so. Well, no one in Fort Worth has been... that unreasonable, but in some ways he has had the Sierra Madre Mountains reforested. And here in Fort Worth, he's contributed to its growth. He speaks for Fort Worth. And he speaks for the country. And I don't know any city that's better represented in the Congress of the United States than Fort Worth. And if there are any Democrats here this morning, I'm sure you won't hold that against them. Three years ago, last September, I came here and the Vice President spoke at Burke Burnett Park. And I called in that speech for a national security policy and a national security system which was second to none. A position which said not first, but if, when, and how, but first. That city responded to that call as it has through its history. And we have been putting that pledge into practice ever since. And I want to say a word about that pledge here in Fort Worth, which understands national defense and its importance to the security of the United States. During the days of the Indian War, this city was a fort. During the days of World War I, even before the United States got into the war, Royal Canadian Air Force pilots were training here. During the days of World War II, the great Liberator bombers, on which my brother flew with his co-pilot from this city, were produced here. First nonstop flight around the world took off and returned here in a plane built in factories here. The first truly intercontinental bomber, the B-36, was produced here. The B-58, which is the finest weapon system in the world today, which it demonstrated most recently in flying from Tokyo to London with an average speed of nearly 1,000 miles per hour, is a Fort Worth product. The Iroquois helicopter from Fort Worth is a mainstay in our fight against the guerrillas in South Vietnam. The transportation of crews between our missile sites is done in planes produced here in Fort Worth. So wherever the confrontation may occur, and in the last 3 years, it's occurred at least three occasions in Laos, in Berlin, and in Cuba, and it will again. Wherever it occurs, the products of Fort Worth. And the men of Fort Worth provide us with a sense of security. And in the not too distant future, a new Fort Worth product. And I'm glad that there was a table separating Mr. Hicks and myself. A new Fort Worth product. The TFX, Tactical Fighter Experimental. Nobody knows what those words mean, but that's what they mean. Tactical Fighter Experimental will serve the forces of freedom and will be the number one airplane in the world today. There's been a good deal of discussion of the long and hard-fought competition to win the TFX contract, but very little discussion about what this plane will do. It will be the first operational aircraft ever produced that can literally spread its wings through the air. It will thus give us a single plane capable of carrying out missions of speed as well as distance, able to fly very far in one form or very fast in another. It can take off from rugged, short airstrips, enormously increasing the Air Force's ability to participate in limited wars. The same basic plane will serve the Navy's carriers, saving the taxpayers at least $1 billion in cost if they built separate planes for the Navy and the Air Force. The government of Australia, by purchasing $125 million of TFX planes before they are even off the drawing board, has already testified to the merit of this plane. And at the same time, it's confident in the ability of Fort Worth to meet its schedule. In all these ways, the success of our national defense depends upon this city in the western United States, 10,000 miles from Vietnam, 5,000 or 6,000 miles from Berlin, thousands of miles from trouble spots in Latin America, in Africa, or the Middle East. And yet Fort Worth and what it does and what it produces participates in all these great historic events. Texas as a whole and Fort Worth bear particular responsibility for this national defense effort. For military procurement in this state totals nearly $1.25 billion, fifth highest among all the states of the Union. There are more military personnel on active duty in this state than any in the nation save one. And it's not Massachusetts. Any in the nation save one with a combined military civilian defense payroll of well over $1 billion. I don't recite these for any partisan purpose. They're the result of American determination to be second to none. And as a result of the effort which this country has made in the last 3 years, we are second to none. In the past 3 years, we have increased the defense budget of the United States by over 20%, increased the program of acquisition for Polaris submarines from 24 to 41, increased our Minuteman missile purchase program by more than 75%, doubled the number of strategic bombers and missiles on alert, doubled the number of nuclear weapons available in the strategic alert forces, increased the tactical nuclear forces deployed in Western Europe by over 60%, added 5 combat-ready divisions to the armies of the United States and 5 tactical fighter wings to the Air Force of the United States, increased our strategic airlift capability by 75%, and increased our special counterinsurgency forces, which are engaged now in South Vietnam, by 600%. I hope those who want a strong America and place it on some signs will also place those figures next to it. This is not an easy effort. This requires sacrifice by the people of the United States. but this is a very dangerous and uncertain world. As I said earlier, on three occasions in the last 3 years, the United States has had a direct confrontation. No one can say when it will come again. No one expects that our life will be easy. Certainly not in this decade, and perhaps not in this century. But we should realize what a burden and responsibility the people of the United States have borne for so many years. Here, a country which lived in isolation, divided and protected by the Atlantic and the Pacific, uninterested in the struggles of the world around it. Here, in the short space of 18 years after the Second World War, we put ourselves by our own will and by necessity into a defensive alliances with countries all around the globe. Without the United States, South Vietnam would collapse overnight. Without the United States, the CETO alliance would collapse overnight. Without the United States, the CENTO alliance would collapse overnight. Without the United States, there would be no NATO, and gradually Europe would drift into neutralism and indifference. Without the effort of the United States and the Alliance for Progress, the communist advance onto the mainland of South America would long ago have taken place. So this country, which desires only to be free, which desires to be secure, which desires to live at peace for 18 years under three different administrations, has borne more than its share of the burden, has stood watch for more than its number of years. I don't think that we are fatigued or tired. We would like to live as we once lived, but history will not permit it. The communist balance of power is still strong. The balance of power is still on the side of freedom. We are still the keystone and the arch of freedom. And I think we will continue to do as we have done in our past, our duty. And the people of Texas will be in the lead. So I'm glad to come. I'm glad to come to this state, which has played such a significant role in so many efforts in this century, and to say that here in Fort Worth, you people will be playing a major role in the maintenance of the security of the United States for the next 10 years. I'm confident, as I look to the future, that our chances for security, our chances for peace, are better than they've been in the past. And the reason is because we're stronger. And with that strength is a determination to not only maintain the peace, but also the vital interests of the United States. To that great cause, Texas and the United States are committed. Thank you.
You've just heard an address by the President of the United States originating from the Texas Hotel in downtown Fort Worth. The President motors from here to Carswell Air Force Base, where Air Force One, the Jet Clipper, will take him and his party to Dallas, where he'll have a noon speaking engagement. From Dallas, he goes to Austin for a Democratic fundraising dinner tonight. Now, this is Gene Kraft and Robert Berry at the Hotel Texas, returning you. The jet hop from Fort Worth to Dallas was a short one. And as usual, huge throngs greeted the President and Mrs. Kennedy at Love Field. There, the President walked along the fence, shaking hands with those who were close enough to reach him. And Mrs. Kennedy appeared delighted to receive a bouquet of roses, red roses, and carried them with her to the car. The presidential limousine, which had been dispatched especially to Dallas for this event, was at the airport. But the skies had cleared. It was determined then that the clear plastic bubble top, which would protect the President from the weather, would not be used. The President, Mrs. Kennedy, Governor, and Mrs. Connolly would ride in the first open car. There had been big crowds in San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth, but the noonday crowd in Dallas was tremendous. Thousands lined the downtown sidewalks, waved from tall buildings, a welcome unmatched in Dallas history. The crowds began to thin as the tour left the downtown area, and suddenly, at 12:31 p.m. on Friday, November 22nd, 1963, the last day of a patriot and president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, ended. Though he is gone, His words still are as bright and eternal as the flame which burns forever over his grave on the Arlington hillside. His words stand as enduring testimonials to the intelligence and wit which made him the recognized spokesman for the free world. On January 20th, 1961, at his inauguration as the 35th and youngest president of the United States, he delivered an address to the nation which has already been accorded a place with the greatest in our nation's history.
We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom, symbolizing an end as well as a beginning, signifying renewal as well as change. For I have sworn before you and Almighty God the same solemn oath our forebears prescribed nearly a century and three quarters ago. The world is very different now, for man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. And yet the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. This much we pledge and more. To those old allies whose cultural and spiritual origins we share, we pledge the loyalty of faithful friends. United, there is little we cannot do in a host of cooperative ventures. Divided, there is little we can do, for we dare not meet a powerful challenge at odds and split asunder. To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny. We shall not always expect to find them supporting our view, but we shall always hope to find them strongly supporting their own freedom, and to remember that in the past, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe, struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. To our sister republics south of our border, we offer a special pledge to convert our good words into good deeds,
in a new alliance for progress to assist free men and free governments in casting off the chains of poverty. But this peaceful revolution of hope cannot become the prey of hostile powers. Let all our neighbors know that we shall join with them to oppose aggression or subversion anywhere in the Americas. And let every other power know that this hemisphere intends to remain the master of its own house. To that World Assembly of Sovereign States, the United Nations, our last best hope, in an age where the instruments of war have far outpaced the instruments of peace, we renew our pledge of support to prevent it from becoming merely a forum for invective, to strengthen its shield of the new and the weak, and to enlarge the area in which its writ may run. Finally, to those nations who would make themselves our adversary, we offer not a pledge, but a request that both sides begin anew the quest for peace. Before the dark powers of destruction, unleashed by science, engulf all humanity in planned or accidental self-destruction, we dare not tempt them with weakness. For only when our arms are sufficient beyond doubt can we be certain beyond doubt that they will never be employed. But neither can two great and powerful groups of nations take comfort from our present course, both sides overburdened by the cost of modern weapons, both rightly alarmed by the steady spread of the deadly atom, yet both racing to alter that uncertain balance of terror that stays the hand of mankind's final war. So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Let both sides explore what problems unite us instead of belaboring those problems which divide us. Let both sides, for the first time, formulate serious and precise proposals for the inspection and control of arms and bring the absolute power to destroy other nations under the absolute control of all nations. Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides unite to heed in all corners of the earth the command of Isaiah to undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free. And if a beachhead of cooperation may push back the jungle of suspicion, let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just and the weak secure, and the peace preserved. All this will not be finished in the first 100 days, nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin. In your hands, my fellow citizens, more than mine, will rest the final success or failure of our course. Since this country was founded, each generation of Americans has been summoned to give testimony to its national loyalty. The graves of young Americans who answered the call to service surround the globe. Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though in battle we are, but a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, a struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. Can we forge against these enemies a grand and global alliance, north and south, east and west, that can assure a more fruitful life for all mankind? Will you join in that historic effort? In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.